You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS.
And Frontline. The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Tuesday, August 28th, 2012. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, the great Jack Hitt and the great Kevin Baker, both writing for Harper's Magazine, or Harper's, I guess, blog, covering the Republican National Convention. They're in the convention hall, I believe, as we speak, talking to us about, well, I guess just how sweaty they are in Tampa at the pulpit. Sure to be fun. Also on the program today, another, well, I don't want to say that these Republican candidates are pro-rape, but they are certainly anti-women fussing about rape in some fashion. I don't know how to characterize this. And really, it's just very difficult to process what a... We're talking about people running for Senate. My God. We'll get to that. We will get to Obama's espousing a desire for a grand bargain. We didn't get there yesterday. Also, Mitt Romney's new line of attack. This turns out to be Mitt Romney's old line of attack. But we will talk about that. And, of course, breaking story. Turns out Rush Limbaugh could be insane. No, he's not insane. He's just a businessman. He's really no different than Alex Jones. We will talk about that a little bit later in the program. And I guess a verdict or a ruling in the Rachel Corrie case in Israel. I'll touch on that as well. First, I want to start off with this. I mean, look, folks, you know, the news is going to be dominated by the convention coverage over the next week and a half. And so I don't know what to tell you. There's a lot of this going on. And, you know, it certainly doesn't warrant 15,000 reporters going on, going down there, but, you know, it is every 4 years, the parties that essentially control our politics come together, and they get together and they meet and they expose different sides of themselves. You know, the Democrats are going to a non-union town, and they're holding their convention at the Bank of America, or I guess Obama is doing his final day of speaking, speechifying at the Bank of America Stadium or whatever it is. I think that is revealing in some respect. The Republicans holding their convention at the basically the nation's capital for strip clubs, without with total disregard for the existence of hurricanes. And then they get together and they talk about how, you know, if a woman gets pregnant via rape. It probably wasn't really rape, because God doesn't allow those type of things to happen. So there is value to these conventions. There is, you know, there is a subtext here. And one of the things that and I would also say there was a great piece in Huffington Post by Adam Green from the PCCC, the Progressive Congressional Caucus. Someone's going to have to tell me what it is. But boldprogressives.org, I know, is his website. And he basically makes a great case. He says all the things that, what is it?
It's the Progressive Change Campaign Committee.
Right, there you go. Progressive Change Campaign Committee. PCCC rolls off the tongue much easier. And he writes that it's really progressives who have the best argument against Republicans. Because, sadly, President Obama, in many respects, followed the Republican playbook or his policies in many respects look too similar in some respects to Republican proposals, because frankly, a lot of them were. Some will argue that was the only way that he could get them passed, and there may be some truth to that. But nevertheless, Adam Green argues that it's really only progressives who can make the best argument against Republican policies, because the progressives are the ones who have a real distinct set of policies from Republican ones. But one of those arguments that President Obama has been making, and that I think is one which I agree with, is the notion that people who have success in this country do so with the help of government, do so with the help of society, government being a manifestation of society, do so with the help of tax dollars and infrastructure that has been in existence many times, not just prior to the business being developed, but the people being alive. And, of course, the Republicans are sort of very awkwardly trying to argue that, no, we built this. All our success is from our genius or determination or sweat. Not from, loans from our parents. But that's still us, not the them out there. And that's the theme they're trying to make. And one of the people who's going to be sort of espousing that is the Delaware Lieutenant Governor candidate, Cher Valenzuela. I think she is speaking during the, if I'm not mistaken, there is a minority block. They've set aside an hour for non-white people to speak at the convention. Yes, that comes tonight in the 9 p.m. hour. Governor Brian Sandoval from Nevada, first Hispanic governor from there, and then remarked by Cher Valenzuela, followed by Senate Republican candidate Ted Cruz, then remarks by Arthur Davis, who is African-American, followed up by Governor Nikki Haley from South Carolina, and then they're basically done, I think, with anybody who is not white for the entire convention. I'm not making that up. And tonight, she's pushing this theme of, we built it. We built it. One of the things that she built was First State Manufacturing. It's a successful small business. And you can see more about that at firststatemfg.com. However, most people, if they Google her business, would probably go to firststatemanufacturing.com. And unfortunately, for her, the internet, which, of course, we know the government actually built, but that's not important. The internet is one of those things where, people can buy domain names. And if you're not smart enough to buy First State Manufacturing, Maybe somebody else might. And then they might, at that site, build a site which outlines just every single government advantage that you got to build that company. Ranging from small business loans to grants to, I mean, it's pretty extensive. So while you're watching her speak tonight in the 1 hour section that they've devoted for anybody who's not white at the Republican convention, be sure to check out firststatemanufacturing.com so that you can tweet it out while she's speaking. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk to the Lily White, Kevin Baker, and the Lily White, Jack Hitt. We'll be right back after this. All right, we are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is an enormous pleasure for me to welcome to the program both Jack Hitt and Kevin Baker, standing about, I think, about 15 yards away from each other somewhere in Tampa. Jack, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Sam. Fortunately, I'm protected from Kevin by 15 armed state policemen.
Fantastic. And Kevin, you are, I understand that you're being subdued by 15 state policemen.
Yeah, I've taken to calling them the brownies. We were calling them brown shirts before, but the color of the uniform is actually closer to a brownie troop-like color. Also, they kind of like these Reno 911 type outfits they're wearing here. many of them are riding bikes, you know. So
now, are you guys? Where are you going now, Kevin? I saw your first dispatch on Harper's. I haven't seen Jack's yet, and maybe you haven't posted one, Jack. But
no, there's a couple up there.
Okay,
check it out.
Oh yeah, we're both up, but we should have a lot more traffic today as we cover the first day of the convention.
Yeah. Okay. So so far, I mean, now let me just I want to give people a little bit of background. Kevin, of course, I remember we were hanging at the DNC 2004. You gave,
yeah.
And Jack, of course, I spent election eve at your house in 2008. You guys are long time sort of, I guess, convention watchers and primary watchers. I mean, Kevin, so let's start with you. Put this into context. I mean, I know that the convention is just now, I guess, officially starting, but put this into context for me.
In terms of the historical context is this is the Republican Party going more and more, you know, to the crazy right wing. As part of our swag in our swag bags yesterday, we got a copy of Mitt Romney's book, No Apologies, which for me is interesting in the sense that, like, this is ironically says a lot more than he means it to say. No apologies is exactly what we've gotten from the Republican Party, and it's kind of remarkable because the last time they had full power, they basically brought this country and much of the world financial system to its knees. The Bush administration was an unmitigated disaster, and yet there has not been, except for maybe occasionally Ron Paul, a single apology for any of this, a single admittance that they did anything wrong from any leading Republican. And it strikes me as kind of amazing. You know, when the Democrats did Vietnam, among other things, there were decades of hand-wringing, a lot of it counterproductive. But at least there was some reassessment of themselves as a party. You know, some of the process that any mature human being or institution goes through to improve, admitting wrong, assessing what they did wrong, absolutely none of this here. You would have thought the 8 years of the Bush administration had never happened.
Jack, what about that? I mean, it seems, you know, my only counter argument to what Kevin is saying is that they did do a reassessment and they found that they didn't go far enough.
Right. You mean, right. Yeah, no, that's the assessment. In fact, they're already preparing for that reassessment in the event that Mitt loses. So understand that because the party rejected the other candidates, the Herman Cains, the Michelle Bachmanns, the Newt Gingriches, the Rick Perrys, right, that came finally and begrudgingly to the decision to embrace Mitt Romney, right? And it's half-hearted. It's showing up in all the polls, right? There's a lack of enthusiasm on this side, just as there is a kind of lack of enthusiasm on Obama's side. But here, it's really focused around Mitt and Mitt's history of flip-flopping and moderation and all that. So if he loses in 8 weeks, 9 weeks, then there'll be a further reassessment and a further push, I think, by the Tea Party into a truer and truer version of what we're seeing displayed here in Tampa.
That's the interesting thing. You know, it's like a party that thinks only in terms of PR now, not policy or reality. Because the reassessment was our message isn't getting across the right way, so we're going to rebrand the extreme right wing of our party, which has been around since Goldwater, as the Tea Party, and bring it on that way. And that worked brilliantly in a tactical sense, but it was no real reassessment of any of their viewpoints or any of their failed policies.
And Jack, I mean, you touched on something about, you know, that Mitt Romney's loss will basically say to them, like, yeah, that's the problem. You just didn't go full-throated nut job right-wing conservative. To what extent are you seeing, like, you know, the convention's obviously very branded around Mitt, but I'm curious as to what extent it's branded around Ryan too, because my theory about why Romney picked Ryan was basically, when I go off this cliff, I don't want to be remembered as the Republican Dukakis. I'm hoping that Paul Ryan at least will deflect some of that blame in some respects, or at least, you know, I'll have the conservative movement in that barrel before we all go off the cliff.
Look, you have two speeches I think you should be listening to very carefully in the next 24 to 48 hours. One is Christie of New Jersey, who's clearly going to use his keynote address to step past the what he sees already as sort of the bones of Mitt Romney in 2012 for a 2016 election. But strangely, I think Paul Ryan might be trying to do the same thing, right? I mean, so you have a kind of, you know, a kind of tough, semi-moderate wing in Christie and this kind of pure-blooded conservatism in Ryan. And those two wings of the party are battling rhetorically. And you'll be seeing bits and pieces of and evidence of that in the speeches we hear in the next day or two.
And Jack, don't move around so much because your phone's giving out a little bit.
Okay, sorry.
I can tell you're trying to get some food or something there.
We're just trying to avoid the lizards here.
You know, I ran into at the Republican National Committee convention in New York in Madison Square Garden. I ran into Rick Hertzberg as I was walking the floor doing our radio show. And he said, I think he said something to the effect of, like, it's almost like walking around normal people.
Yeah, and they seem very nice, some of them. You know, somebody I'm going to blog about later today is this woman delegate from Wisconsin who was from Ryan's district, loves him to pieces. And, you know, she was talking about kind of, I asked her something about the Ryan plan for replacing Medicare with vouchers. And her feeling is that pensions don't work, period. And that pensions
that what?
Create...
That what? Pensions don't work?
Pensions don't work, private or public.
Yeah, pensions.
She claims to know
public
this because...
private don't work. Right.
Yeah. And she claims to know this because she's in human resources. And she claims that, you know, they just create dependency. I mean, I asked her, what do you intend to, replace this with? And she said, like, well, it's a chicken or the egg sort of thing. Her feeling is that the fact that pensions came into being led to people to be less concerned about taking care of their aged relatives. So, you know, I very carefully brought up a personal example, which is my mother, who died of an extended illness, Huntington's disease, one which creates, you know, severe dementia and all kinds of other problems. And as an example of, like, who, you know, how were we supposed to, my wife and I were supposed to take care of her, you know, a 700-square-foot apartment and, our jobs and, you know, states, you know, two states away and all this sort of thing, to which her reply was, and this, I think, speaks to her humanity, but her reply was, huh, well, maybe there's a middle ground. So, you know, it's like this sort of my utter intellectual confusion, if you can actually get, if you can actually break through to people's humanity, you know, is there. And I think that speaks well to them as people. But what's amazing is the sort of, are the sort of intellectual cliches they will endorse at a drop of a hat.
It is pretty stunning, the bubble. I mean, that, you know, I experienced this when I went down to Glenn Beck's 828 rally, the bubble that they live in. And it's actually quite permeable if you can actually get close enough to permeate it. Which is fascinating, because you would imagine, like, you know, someone would have brought up a counterexample to the human resources lady at one point or another, and I guess
right. Nobody
had.
Well, and the amazing thing
she had this complete kind of bizarre theory about what has happened in the last 100 years, is that we all lived on these kind of simple Walton family-like farms, and we took care of the elderly, and then one day we abandoned them all selfishly because the government stepped in and paid for everything.
Right.
And I asked this, well, don't you think, like, sort of urbanization might have happened in between there, and that we were all following the free market? and trying to get, you know, better and better jobs, and so families broke up because of that. Oh, yeah, she said, yeah, maybe that.
Well, yeah. I mean, Jack, isn't this an indictment of Kevin? I mean, he's a historian. This is something that, I mean, you know, if anybody knows how many people were sleeping on the Bowery in 1915, it would be Kevin Baker, right?
Well, the other thing I find really amazing is that this is capitalism. What makes pensions work, and they do work very well if done properly, is capitalism. It's you put in money every week, every month, and that gets invested in something, and it grows thanks to the wonders of compound interest and the wonders of capitalism. And here's this person who espouses utter capitalism for everything and is part of the capitalism party. And she doesn't seem to understand how capitalism works. And it's something amazing to me. I mean, it's something like an emotional desire, and I think most of politics is emotion, but an emotional desire to go back to some pastoral, you know, purely agricultural, almost barter system, you know, and it's dressed up with Ayn Rand and all this other kind of nonsense, but it is no relation to real capitalism.
Well, the other problem is that there's never really been a barter system. That's sort of that's sort of bunk, actually. But I mean, there's been barter, but no system. But you know, when I hear a response like that from a person like that, I'm not thinking that she is really Ayn Randian as much as she is a Christian fundamentalist. I mean, I would guess that notion of that somehow pensions have created a basically become an addicting sort of destructive force on families. That to me sort of sounds like someone who is a Christian more than they are a capitalist.
Go ahead, Kevin. No, I was going to say a Christian and a nostalgist, you know, in the way that Spalding Gray described it, which was the longing for something that never was. And I think that's the emotional reach for these people. They want the Waltons. And, you know, the fact that the Waltons barely existed, and when they did, it was a damned hard life. Kind of never gets across.
Right. I also thought, you know, when Kevin describes his mother's situation and him being two states away and trying to deal with all that, and he said, you know, what would you suggest that I do? And her first answer was, she was horrified. And she said, I don't know. I don't have an answer to your question, was her first answer. And then she said, maybe there's a middle ground. But, you know, it's sort of like, like so many of these party, attendees, they have this idea in their head. And the real world never really enters into the calculation of how that idea is supposed to work. You know, in her mind, it's all these moochers out there who are taking this money and unfairly, you know, just kind of living, you know, high on the hog, right? And here Kevin comes along with an actual story with actual human beings in it, actually struggling to make, the day. And she's absolutely moved by it and completely baffled as to how her ideology is supposed to work under normal human circumstances.
What is a middle ground?
Yeah, exactly. That's undefined. But I mean, I thought that was the first step toward recovery in a way. I think most of us would love to see some middle ground. We would love to have debates on actual solutions.
Right.
But instead, all we get are these, you know, kind of emotional tendencies that override everything else. And Republicans are terrific at that. They've been doing this for so long, going back to Ronald Reagan, with his welfare queens riding around in Cadillacs. You know, it's a way of making the other a complete alien. And this is what's killing American politics, and we'll kill our democracy if we don't stop it.
Right, right. You know, when we got off the airplane and got in the cab or the shuttle to go pick up our rental car, the first billboard sign we saw coming out of the airport was this enormous, well-lit sign in the dark that said, "Don't believe the liberal media." You know, and you know, there is this complete rejection of what the other side has to say. There is no listening to it. I mean, like this woman was sort of suggesting, there's a moocher class out there, and she's against it. Now, when one of those people actually describe the human situation, well, then she's baffled, because that's, you know, the shibboleth and the propaganda. There's just this enormous, you know, welfare class that's living off of her dime. And when something shows up that doesn't jive with the propaganda, she's authentically moved by that story. Just the sort of way Reagan was. You remember how Ronald Reagan was? Any individual would approach him at a campaign stop and tell them their sob story, he'd be like, oh, my God, he can call an aide over. Do that! You know? And then you just turn right around and reject an enormous policy that might have addressed that issue.
Now let me ask you, like, do you think that this woman would see that she's engaged in a class war? And the class war in this instance is whatever class she perceives herself, and then this other class of welfare teat suckers and poor people or infirm people or.
I would think class war. You mean like working class versus upper class? Because she doesn't see it that way at all.
I mean, I'm saying that there's the accusation that some of us on the left are engaged in a class war, middle class versus the, 99% versus the 1%. And frankly, I acknowledge the existence of that class war. That's where I see the battle lines. But she's engaged in a class war, class war as well. It's just that the battle lines are actually between, sort of like the upper, the 40 or 50% and up, or 30% and up, and then the 30% and below.
Yeah. I think she would just like to. I think she would feel she's freeing poor people from their dependence,
right,
on the state and on Medicare. For something better. And this is.
I mean, how do you combat this? Because I think there's like a loss of institutional or, I guess, national memory of why there was so much clamoring for these programs in the first place. I mean, I've had debates with the young libertarians, for instance, who are just like, it was better. People, it was better. There was no poverty in 1920.
Right. Oh, it's amazing the lack of any kind of historical. Now, I was saying to her, trying to be kind of flattering about Wisconsin, because all these delegates were posing as the Wisconsin standard, the state standard in the convention center. So they wanted to be, posing this. And I said, well, why is it that Wisconsin's always been at the heart of, or for a long time, it's been at the heart of social change, going back to La Follette and the, and the Progressive Party and the moving the Republican Party, to the left. And, she didn't kind of get that at all. She was willing to very much take state pride, but she obviously had little to no idea who the La Follettes were or any of the history of her state, which has been a terrific laboratory for democracy in some ways. She thinks of her state as she called it, flyover territory, where people from the big cities fly over and don't care about it at all. The idea that there are actually large cities in Wisconsin, such as Milwaukee, that it's an industrialized place, never registered. In her mind, Wisconsin is indeed this kind of pastoral paradise. It's practically Dorothy's farm in Kansas. And the rest of us are a bunch of snotty Eastern or Western elites flying back and forth between Manhattan and Hollywood and, throwing our chewing gum out the window at poor Wisconsin.
She realize that planes don't go that north when they're going from New York to L.A.?
Right. We should have said, you're not even flyover territory.
I just add to that I think, people like her have this completely nostalgic view of what happened before the 30s. And forget that, many cities had, a little bureau whose job it was just to go around in the morning and collect dead bodies in a cart, I remember reading this essay about how children have this kind of distorted view of death because it's been so sanitized and removed to hospitals. And this person was describing how it was very common in the early part of the 20th century for children to encounter dead people all the time because often old people died on park benches. And grandma, of course, died at home. But death was just sort of around us all the time. A lot of that elderly dying and the just terrible state of old age was remedied by Social Security. But we've forgotten that. We now think that this is Walton Path that we've given up on, right?
Yeah. And even in Paul Ryan's own district, Janesville, right, is the central city. I mean, that was like an old factory town. when factories left. You know, and if that registers with her at all, I don't know. But I mean, this is industrial America. That place that very much worked on, you know, pensions and the like for a long time. People on an assembly line doing very hard, very industrial work. But in her mind, it's still the Wisconsin of, little dairy farms.
So, guys, I mean, and hopefully we can touch base again, maybe on Thursday. But just give me a sense of security. You guys have been to a lot of conventions. I understand that the security there is just completely out of control.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Was an entire car full of armed state troopers who just drove by. Some of them on bicycles, backpacks. Many of them, every state or every governmental law enforcement agency that perhaps you've ever heard of is here. You see people in Secret Service outfits, state troopers, National Guard, county police, sheriff's deputies, local Tampa police. They're everywhere. I'd say there's about, in fact, I did the math this morning, there's about one armed trooper for every delegate, every two delegates here at the convention, and certainly almost one for the media.
One of the things we were blogging about yesterday is going through downtown, and all these guys, these are the only people in downtown, and they're kind of gathered together because they have nothing else to do. And then at one point, out of the blue, came these, like, literally nine anarchists chanting slogans, obscene slogans against Romney and Obama. And they were immediately surrounded by all these security, who seemed actually kind of glad to see them. You know, they were kind of smiling. They offered the anarchists Gatorade, which the anarchists drank, you know, because anarchists get dehydrated too, damn it. But, you know, this was like, you quite clearly saw this was like their reason to be. You know, this is the reason for their budgets, the reason they're out here, and they were just very happy to see that there was some reason for them to be walking around downtown Tampa.
Wow. And today, of course, is the We Built It Day today, right?
Okay.
Yeah. And we will be in a convention center built by the federal government. So
yeah.
That is going to line up nicely with President Obama's speech in the Bank of America football stadium or whatever it is. So,
I mean, we built it or we refinanced it. You know, coming through some of No Apologies, the Romney book again last night, and among other things, he's bragging again about his big killing with Bain Capital, which was getting Staples. Off and going. And I think about the ludicrousness of this. This guy's writing about putting funding behind a office supply company that already existed to make office supplies cheaper as a major capitalist achievement. And he's trying to make it sound like Andrew Carnegie refining the steel process so you can mass produce steel, you know, and change the world almost overnight. I mean, you know, these people are pygmies standing in the shoes of giants and shouting that they're the real giants. You know, that's amazing.
Well, guys, thanks so much for joining us today, and hope to talk to you soon. We've got a link up to your blog at Harper's so that people can check out your dispatches, and I can't wait to hear what you've got to say later in the week after you've experienced the full force of Republican convention. Guys, thanks again.
All right. Bye-bye.
All right, folks. Well, that takes us to the end of the better half of the, or the lesser half of the program, as I like to call it. Please join us in the better half, if you will. And you may by becoming a member of the Majority Report at majority.fm. Where else are you going to hear? Yeah, I guess, you know, occasionally on NPR, This American Life, you'll hear Jack Hitt. And in the finer upper-end radio programs, occasionally you'll hear Kevin Baker. When will you hear them both live on the in the convention? Probably never, except for on this program. Is that not worth a membership of this program to continue it, to support it? I can't hear what you said because right now nobody's on the phone and you're just talking to your iPod. So whatever your answer was, all I'm going to hear is, yes, Sam, it is actually now that you mention it. How would I go about doing so? Well, I'll tell you, person, who asked me that question. You go to majority.fm and you click on become a member. And then you pay your pocket change on a daily basis, not even. And then you support the show and it continues on forever and ever. You know, within reason. Let's not get carried away. If you don't, then it ends at one point. I don't know when that happens. I don't know if it's when Nikki says, hey, it could be time for you to get some health insurance is not going to cost us $45,000 a year or something. It could happen then. It could just be like when Mila says, oh, I need braces or whatever it is. I don't know. There's many other ways to support the show. Click on the support the show button at majority.fm, but become a member today or tomorrow. Sometime between today and tomorrow, become a member, please. We need your support. We're in a month or two, well, I guess it's 2.5 months. This is when they send me the bill and they say, we're going to raise your rent and you got to sign another year-long lease. And I got to go through the numbers again and figure out if this is going to work and see if we picked up enough new members over the past year. And, you know, just make it easy for me, folks, please. All right. You can call the program 646-257-3920. 646-257-3920. You can email, IM me at Majority FM or, on most of your IM clients, or you can do it through majorityfm@jabber.org. Put that into your IM mechanism. Tomorrow on the program, also reporting from the convention, will be Tina Dupuy, Michael Tracy, who's going out with some, I think, the Occupy people today, has written a piece, I think it was in Salon. Or Slate, one of those S things. And we will hear from him later in the week. Andy Kindler, I think he'll probably be talking to us on Friday. He'll have been there all week. Hopefully we can have Jack and Kevin back Thursday, because by then these guys, I could listen to them talk forever. And honestly, forever, if they were on a better phone connection. But certainly 40 minutes on the phone connection they were on today. I'll take your phone calls. In the better half, we will talk about the latest in my grand bargain watch. President Obama giving you a clue of what to expect. It's not great. Which is not to say that Romney and Ryan isn't worse, because they are. Do you really think there's no difference? No difference between the Medicare available to you today and a defined contribution. Here's a check. See what you can buy with it. No guarantee of health care coverage. Just a guarantee of some money towards that. I know right now, if one of you said to me, hey, I could give you $10 a month, or I could provide you guaranteed health insurance, guess what I would take? Also, the latest Republican candidate to espouse some views on rape and women's sovereignty over their own bodies. We'll get to that in just a moment in the better half. See you there.